Herman Holter, Reel 12.
Amongst the group of the boys they met up and lived with in Theresienstadt, I found that they had different sensitivities, different sensibilities. They came from a different home background. And suddenly, in a melange like that, we sorted one another out. And my friend became Ben Helfgott. There was somebody called Erich Hirschbeck. He later on became a mathematician and a reader at King's College in mathematics. He was very brilliant till a time when he had a brain hemorrhage and that hampered him. But he managed to get a PhD. He's still alive, but he's rather strange now. He's become a great cynic. He was a lovely person after the war. And there were people there who one felt very privileged in finding. There was Artur Poznański. His parents, both parents, were teachers. And he knew so much about poetry, and one went for walks there in Theresienstadt, he could recite poetry. What was also interesting looking back is that none of us wanted to revenge ourselves against German. We felt that the bestiality was so wrong, although it inflicted on our people and our parents, that it was abhorrent to us, that our home background as children taught us that this is bestial and inhuman. And there was an incident when Ben Helfgott once came back, and he said he saw two women trying to beat up German women or German men or so, and he interfered. He was very strong by nature. Somehow he had the inborn strength, physical strength, and he tore them apart. He said, "You should be ashamed of yourself to do this," and he saved the life of the people. One can understand that some people who were brutalized wanted to revenge themselves, but this sort of revenge did not linger in our hearts. We suddenly reverted back to the home background, to the teaching that we received as very young children. And yet, when we came to England, we were misunderstood. They thought that the life there perverted us and brutalized us, that certain families felt that the children must not be associated with us, that we went through this hell and most probably have become also infected and affected by it. And so many of the Jewish families refused to send their children to the hostel in which we were in order to meet us. This later on became very evident. Rather than get the warmth of company and free invitation, they felt that it's natural that these experiences must have completely ruined them as people. There's somebody called Helen Bamber. She's of Amnesty International. And she's slightly older than we are, and she recounted that how other people ostracized us because they were afraid that their children might be infected by us. It was not very easy when we came to England because after the recuperation in Windermere...
Yes, perhaps it would be as well to go through it chronologically, do you think? Could you tell me first of all about this plan for getting the boys to England? Who was it organized, you?
I don't remember the name of the doctor. I think Ben Helfgott remembers him. But he conceived this idea of getting in touch with the Jewish Refugee Committee, who later on became CBF, and to obtain permits for us to come to England. The Foreign Office issued a permit that those of us who are age 16 should be allowed to come because they felt that in the questions House of Parliament that anybody over 16 would deprive ex-servicemen from jobs. So only those who were 16, but our card was stamped as 16, and somehow we were all 16 on that. Some who were really 15 became also 16. And permission was granted for 1,000 boys and girls brought over, but only 732 were found. So we came in the transport of 732. And the Jewish Refugee Committee, who later, as I said, became CBF, managed to get Lancaster bombers to bring us from Prague and fly us to Carlisle. And our very small group that I was with were met by Leonard Montefiore. And he was very kind and charitable. And somebody said, "This is a very aristocratic English Jew, Leonard Montefiore." And I said, "Oh, nonsense. He wears such an old suit. How can be aristocratic and wealthy?" And he understood all that, our conversation between us. And he sat there and held a little child who was 12 on his lap from Carlisle to Lake Windermere. And really, he was the one who later on took such an interest, loving interest in us, without reservations. Now, the group itself formed certain groupings, and according to the groupings that we formed, we were put in hostels. And some of them, Leonard Montefiore, who was a very liberal man, decided that we should not get instructions from one group of Jewish people. So there were young people who came in the kinder transport before the war, who are teachers, and some people who were who had conservative leaning, who had socialist leanings, who had the religious leanings, semi-religious leanings, they all became teachers in Windermere. And the very Orthodox used to say, if you come to pray during morning and afternoon, you get chocolate, which they managed to get from Switzerland. Of course, quite a lot wanted the chocolate. We never had chocolate there. But quite a lot of the group became very Orthodox. And a colleague of ours, Liberman, who was an intelligent young man with whom we used to go for walks in Theresienstadt, became a very Orthodox person who lived now in Svart, and people come to him, very Orthodox people, to ask him advice. He became a sage. Kuchmierski, too, is a very Orthodox person, the one I showed you the photograph of in Stamford Hill. His son is a scribe of Torah. He lives very frugally, very in great poverty. And he has great dignity, although he is Orthodox. Some of them have become Orthodox, very bigoted. They never accepted people like Hugo Grin because he was a reform rabbi. They felt he was diluting Jewishness. So you find from this whole spectrum, different people develop in different ways. I had a great craving to become educated, and when I realized that my aunt has not flown over or sent somebody to collect me, to take me to Switzerland, I was slightly lost about this. And that is now in Windermere, but do you want me to go back to Theresienstadt, or shall I continue with the Windermere?
Yes, perhaps it would be interesting to know what happened with your aunt. And why, you know, you weren't sort of looked after by her.
Well, what happened was that eventually when I was in England in 1948 and I saved up enough money to visit her, I went over to Switzerland. And when the whole family, cousins and aunt and her children sat around the table, I stood up and I said, "My aunt, could you please translate, because I can't speak French." And I said to her in Polish, "That I'm now ready to come over." I was 3 years in England, and they all looked down their noses. And then I was taken aside and explained that aunt and uncle are not so young. They can't take the responsibility of looking after me and of sending me to school and pay for our education, for my education. That I would be too much of a burden. And now that I'm in England, I better carry on with my life in England. I was apprenticed, and they gave me a watch, which on the way back to England I threw into the channel. That was a payoff. I didn't understand the Swiss mentality, and the Swiss steel entered their soul. And that too became a very hard lesson to swallow, because the family was warm and open-hearted and full of hospitality, and I could not understand that my aunt and uncle would behave like that.
But going to Windermere, you know, arriving as you did in your Lancaster, was it?
Yes.
Plane. What was your impression when you arrived, you know, after war-torn Europe, to arrive in the Lake District?
The impression first was on Prague airfield. We're loaded up, and I saw this very tall officer, I don't know whether he was wing commander, who was talking from the corner of his mouth and emitting these very quick sounds. And I thought, I would never learn that language. It sounded to me like boiling potatoes. And he had to pipe one corner of the mouth, and the sound came from another corner of the mouth. And he was talking to other people with this moustache. And I stood there below and looked at him, and I thought to myself, oh, my goodness me, strange language, spoken so terribly fast. But he was very nice, and he came round when we sat there in the Lancaster bomber and asked his crew to take off their flying hats, which looked very attractive, and put them on our heads. And we all tried, and we all felt like pilots. And Carlisle were open with a sort of tea reception. There was not a single slice of black bread, all beautifully white. We hadn't seen that before. And I said, we come to a country of milk and honey. And all these lovely ladies there who fussed about and bread with jam and honey and stuff. It was wonderful. And they all smiled and looked at us. And we thought we landed on another planet. And then we're taken to Windermere. There was a place between Windermere and Ambleside called Troutbeck Bridge, where there was a factory of some sort, I think hydroplanes. And before it was occupied during the war by workers who lived there, and they put us in these little single-story huts. It was wonderful. We were given clean vests and a clean shirt and clean underpants and clean trousers, and the sheets were clean, and there were showers, and we thought, oh, marvelous. And there was a dining room, food, and kippers were served, and they gave us pocket money, and I quickly learned that I liked row keepers. So I saw that in Windermere, and I worked out that if I spend some of my money on these row keepers, I will enjoy this more, because the doctor said I should eat as much as I can in order to put some weight on, and meat and muscle. So I thought, English is just like German, you just twist certain words around. So I took some of my pocket money, took this sixpence, went in, put it on the counter, and I said to the man, I become kipper. And he said, if you like. So I said it again. So he said, just a minute, called his wife, and he said, say it again. So I said, I become kipper, and became quite angry. So he said something like, if you like, and I took my sixpence and walked out, and I was very angry that he was trying to make fun of me. So I thought, what have I said wrong? And I pointed at these kippers, and till eventually I found out how to ask for a kipper. It was quite interesting, but the committee employed certain people to look after us who were not suitable to be overseers. And one man, you will see his face in the book about the boys, called Oscar Friedman, who was in orphanage in Berlin before the war, well before the war, and came also during the Kinder transport, and he was an amateur psychiatrist, psychoanalyst. And about five or six of us once walked out from the camp in Windermere to go to cinema, and he stopped us at the gate, and he always wore a bow tie. The photograph in the book, The Boys by Sir Martin Gilbert, is also him wearing a bow tie. And he said in German to us, your friends are wearing a shirt and you wear a vest. Where are you going? So I said, to Windermere, to the cinema. So So he said, but why are you going in a vest? So I said, because it's clean and I feel very comfortable and it's warm enough. So he said, that's not the answer. So he said, what is the right answer? So I said, because up till now I didn't have a vest like that. So I'm very proud of having a vest and I feel good in it. So he said, that's not the answer. So he said, now tell me the right answer. So my friend sort of listened to me attentively. So I said, because I don't want to look like you. So my friends laughed, and he from then on took very much against me, and he was very influential on the committee. So when it came to classification, classified me as average, below average in intelligence, and I was sent to work together with another chap in a factory, a steel factory, because I was a metal worker during the war, and had to stand by a furnace where crowns for drilling were hardened. It was hot work, it was dirty work. And I told myself, this is terrible, I want some education, I want to learn something. So I went on strike and I decided not to get up. I lay on my bed, collected my pocket money, went to Foyles and asked somebody, very nice Foyles, what books would he recommend for me to improve my English? And he said, well, I would get Lewis Carroll, J.B. Priestley, Reading for Pleasure. And so I came away with a stack of books and lay on my bed and taught myself. And the committee, together with Oscar Friedman, had a tremendous problem what to do with me. When they came, eventually, sternly to say, you must go to work. This is no way of behaving. So I said, well, you have one option. Either you shoot me or send me back to concentration camp. I just did not want to compromise. I refused. I became... Till one day, somebody came along. And he said, I'm managing director of a firm, which is an offshoot of an aircraft company. And the firm is in Slough, called Structural and Mechanical Development Engineers. I understand that when you don't read, you draw. Why don't you come and be apprenticed there? So he took me there on a Monday and showed me around the works, and he said, you see, you signed that you become apprenticed here. You get so much per week, which was £4.16, and you find yourself digs in Windsor, and you'll be quite independent of the committee. And that appealed to me. And I accepted gratefully, and then he explained that first I have to spend so much time in the workshop, then the drawing office, and eventually in the design office. And I began after 1 year and 3.5 months, I was quite independent. I worked at Slough, at Structural and Mechanical Development Engineers, and I lived in Windsor, and I cycled in to work. And the people who were the mob there took it in turn to teach me math, geography, English, and life was wonderful. And I joined a swimming club, and I became a county champion. and every day after work, I spent half an hour, 3/4 of an hour, where they taught me. And eventually, when I finished my apprenticeship, I was qualified to study architecture. And it was really wonderful. They also pulled my leg quite a lot because one wing commander who took me for English used to say, tonight's homework is Roman, is you is or is you ain't my baby. You have to find what's wrong with it. And I would take it all very seriously and go back and puzzle it out. My digs, my room, was very small to such an extent that I made myself a flap on the door. So when I entered, I put the flap down so I can do my homework. Otherwise, it consists of a bed and a window. The landlady was very kind. She was a very old grandmother who looked after a grandchild girl because the father, during the Second World War, was killed in Italy. And that was her daughter's husband. And the daughter was so in love with the husband that she refused to live and she died and she left a little girl, and the girl was then 9, and the grandma used to look after her. This granddaughter lives now in Milton Keynes, and she calls me my eldest brother. So we still keep in touch.
This would have been, you would have left Windermere with the boys by that time, I imagine, and gone on to London. Were you still as a group?
Yes, after Windermere they sent us, my group, my few selected groups, were sent to a hostel in Loughton.
Loughton,
yes, and we were in the middle of a forest almost, in a very nice house, which was called the Manor House. And there were about 30-odd people. The selection was very well done, because we suddenly found one another, and this group that got on so very well together was sent to the same hostel. And it was a lovely place, fresh air, and Windermere lasted only a few months, I don't know, 2 or 3 months.
Was the idea of that to build you up, do you think, to get your health back?
Yes, we were under medical supervision. Some of them had TB and they were sent to a sanatorium. And also to find out what sort of other extraordinary things we develop. And then gradually they wanted us to be out because the committee was very short of money. And if they found that some boys or girls did not have an interest in education, they were sent to work. Most of them who came from a sort of tailoring background went to become tailors, other became something else, and we all missed the education. They should have given us a greater education, really, because the whole group was very enterprising and very able in a way, but it took quite a lot of time to find their feet, and their children have shown great ability. I mean, both my children were scholars in Cambridge. Many of the children now from the Holocaust survivors, from the boys, are professional people and very able.
You were saying that there were 1,000 places originally,
yes,
and that only 732 children,
yes,
or 16 were found.
That's
or boys.
All, yes.
Were they all boys? Did they have
no
boys?
There were about 80 girls amongst them. But boys were easier to use as slave labor than girls. That's why boys, Jewish slave labor, many more boys survived. Jewish slave laborer had about a span of 3 months. With luck, some had a little bit more. And it was really murder through slave labor, because apart from guessing and Einsatzgruppe shooting, Jewish slave labor was also destined to be finished off. And many SS, and we're constantly under SS supervision, felt that if somebody was weak enough to not able to slave labor, he or she were finished off very quickly.
Do you think, though, you know, bearing in mind that they didn't fulfill that target of 1,000 children, it seems, you know, there must have been an enormous need. There must have been a lot more than 1,000.
Well, later on, when we were brought to England, others were combed through Germany, but they found their way to other countries. Many also went to Palestine and wanted to go to Palestine. Others went from other areas of Europe, they were in DP camps, went to America or Canada. And some other ones, then after that, there was somebody called Rabbi Sheinfeld who brought them to the shelter in East End. He found another group of boys and girls. So those who came here flourished, really. From the 732, they also dispersed to other places. They went later on either to Israel, when Israel became a state, or Canada, or United States. But we still, in our letter of the 45 Society that we have formed, remained quite a cohesive group. I used to go to Israel to meet somebody who was in Theresienstadt, living very close to me, And when he married, he moved to Ashkelon. He went very early on from England. He fought in the War of Independence, married and settled out in Ashkelon, became an estate agent, and then he became a travel agent. And when I visited him, he had a young family. I slept in the sitting room, and the youngest boy of about 2 at night used to tramp along to the Baron's bedroom. In the morning, I found him lying close to me, and I was all wet on one side. And then when I met him next time, he was a sort of 6'2" soldier, and I said, "Perhaps you don't remember, but we've known each other for a very long time. You wetted my side." But we still are very good friends, and wherever we go, that it's just like arriving to a family. We pick up bits where we left off, and we are very welcome. Yet education, culture, way of life changed us. For instance, that fellow, Leibel Silberschatz, I visited him in Canada. And because he had such raw sensibilities, when I came and I contacted him, he came, collected me by car, and he's a butcher now. Very rough, very tough. And he took me to his home, and he and his wife have this head, they are quite grown up now, these lovely 2 children. And the father, who's rough, I could hardly understand, speaking in a sort of not Hungarian, but Canadian slur of pidgin English. I understood the children much better than I could understand him. I thought, there's this gulf of work and culture. And I took the children, the boy was a bit bigger than the girl, and I said to the 2 little mites, "What can I get you?" And the boy said, "I like reading," said the little boy. So I took him to a shop. It was all the shops there in the mall were underground. And took him to the shelf where the children's books were. And suddenly I lost him. And I went looking in the shop and looking around other shops, and I could not find him anywhere. So I alerted some people in other shops, and we all looked. And when we came back to this shop, original shop, there in the corner behind the other shelves, he was sitting and reading this book. But the father could hardly read. When he was reading a paper, his lips were moving, and he liked talking about the past in a very strange way. So I had, years later, the invitation that the son took a doctorate, and he's a learned man. But I'm sure the gulf between him and his father must be enormous.